The book of Acts, chapter 18, verses 18 through 23. Acts, chapter 18, verses 18 through 23. And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren and sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. Having shorn his head in Cenchrea, for he had a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there, but he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they desired him to tarry longer time with them, he consented not, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that comes in Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you, if God will. And he sailed from Ephesus. And when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up and saluted the church, he went down to Antioch. And after he had spent some time there, he departed and went over all the country of Galatia and Phrygian order, strengthening all of the disciples. As we think of Paul, it's usually Paul the Apostle. And that statement, or description, or title attached to his name, Paul the Apostle, brings to my mind at least a man accused of a crime against the Roman Empire, a man accused of blasphemy by the Jews, a man sometimes convicted, sometimes beaten, sometimes stoned, oftentimes brutalized. And Paul himself gives us a statement of his sufferings, and they were tremendous. And there's no question about his suffering. But there were many other aspects in the life of Paul, and most of them unknown to us. But when Paul wrote to Timothy, he wrote of his faith, that is, of Paul's faith, and he wrote of his manner of life. He uses that phrase, 2 Timothy 3:10 through 11, and says, you know my manner of life. This simply means that Paul knew that Timothy was conscious of his lifestyle. And I believe these words that we've read this morning give us an indication of Paul's lifestyle, of how he lived, and the consistency that Paul had in his life. And I realize that we're not any of us Apostle Pauls. You know, sometimes we hear the statement, well, now we're not all Apostle Pauls here in this congregation. And that's true, and there are not any of us that are Apostle Pauls. And I think we have to understand that there's only been one in the history of the church. There have been people who have done wonderful things for the Lord and lived consistently and victoriously. There's been only one Apostle Paul, and by the way, there's been only one of you. We are unique to ourselves. Whatever God expects of one, he may not expect that of the other, in the sense of the lifestyle, in the sense of where we go and what we do, but God expects morality, expects honesty, expects discipline, all these things from all of us. We're not the same. What one person does with ease, another person must labor to do. What one person can do through natural ability, as we'll study this evening, as we study the life of Apollos, another must study long and hard to develop the ability to do a certain thing. But Paul had a lifestyle, a manner of life. And again, let me say, I think we see it in these sort of disjointed, brief statements of his traveling from this place to that place, and of some probably what we'd consider extremely minor parts of his life. And yet Luke, the historian, has sought to give us information about Paul. I'd like to point out what I believe to be a fact about Paul and his life as we read in verse 18, and that is, time did not tyrannize the life of Paul. I don't think Paul lived his life as hectically as some would have us think. I realize that as we read the book of Acts, it rushes us through an entire ministry, an entire span of life. And if we're not careful, we'll get the idea that here was a man who was hectic in his lifestyle, rushing from this place to that place, unsure of who he was and uncertain of what he was doing. And I think if we get that idea of Paul, we misunderstand the man completely. And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while. After being acquitted before the judgment seat of Gallio, Paul then simply remained for a while at this particular place. And it speaks of a man who's given to knowing who he is and what he's doing, and to believing that to be a part of life is not to waste time. And I think we make a bad judgment about life when we make a judgment that if we're not praying, if we're not reading the Bible, we're not involved in some specific religious activity, then all the other is a waste of time. I think that's one of the tyrants that drives our generation and drives them to make the many mistakes that we make. We're caught up in a treadmill or on a treadmill of activity, of rushing and rushing and literally being tyrannized by time until we've lost our sense of balance. I worked with my cousin and his two sons, who are carpenters. And when they get started, you better get out of their way, because they work fast and they work hard. And my cousin continually makes a statement to them, and I'm sure they are tired of hearing it. I finally got tired of hearing it myself. And that statement is, "Come on, son, we're burning daylight. You boys, come on, we're burning daylight." Well, I thought that's funny until he started telling me, "Hey, bring that saw over here. We're burning daylight." And when we was eating dinner, we was burning daylight. I mean, when it's 102 and we were just perspiring like everything, and I was just about to collapse out of weariness and heat prostration, he says, "We're burning daylight." You know, you get to thinking about it, and that'll get to be a real tyrannical master, a despot in your life, that hook, "We're burning daylight. We got to do something." You know, one of the real tragedies of America is that people quit building front porches on their houses. I don't know why they did that. Maybe to save lumber, labor, price, etc. I don't know. When I built mine, I built one just as wide as I could get it and just as long as I could get it. Because you know some very fond memories of mine are connected to a front porch. I don't think we were burning daylight when we were sitting on the porch. You know, people sit on a cane bottom chair right up on the front porch. Somebody drive down in a car every once in a while and I was wondering where they're going, you know. I don't know. What do you think they're going to do? I don't know. He wasn't driving very fast. You know, just sit there and just, you know, wonder what's going on. Say, boy, they're just wasting their life. No. No, they wasn't wasting their life. I think Paul had some control of his life. That's what I'm trying to tell you. That he had some respect for the little things that make up the big things. That Paul was willing to tarry here but felt impelled to leave Ephesus. Here was a man who could see things that were important and things that were not so important to move him from this place to that place. The Bible tells us that after he tarried there yet a good while, that he then took his leave of the brethren. It hasn't the idea that if Paul has his ways, not being pushed out of a city by people with rocks to stone him to death, that he's willing to fit into a particular circumstance of almost leisureliness. We think about Jesus, and Jesus was a creature of time. I think, and I feel pretty strongly about this, that Jesus lived quietly. He might have quickened his steps from time to time, but I don't believe that Jesus ever hurried. I think he lived with patience, waiting for what he chose to call his hour. I think all of us have an hour in the scheme of God's things. And that we need to live quietly and patiently, not always thinking that to spend a little time with our wife or with her husband or with our children or to just sit and drink an extra cup of coffee, go out on the patio and spend some time away from the television or whatever. I don't think this is ever wasted time. That it's good time and quality time and time that God would have us use. And then as I look at these scriptures, the Bible tells us that Paul cut his hair. And the reason that he had let his hair grow is because he had a vow. And that tells me something of Paul's private life, of his concern and consideration, and of that which evidently was important to him. We have no idea what this vow was that Paul had made. It was evidently a brief vow, that is, a vow of probably 30 days in length and a time when he abstained from drinking wine or from cutting his hair. There was, according to historians, a circumstance of a temporary Nazirite vow that lasted for 30 days, during which abstinence from wine was practiced and the hair was not cut. And the cutting of the hair marked the termination of this vow. Some have speculated that Paul vowed a vow to God because of what he'd experienced here in the city of Corinth by not being driven out by the system of law that protected him from the madness of the Jews who sought to destroy him. That maybe Paul had a vow of thanksgiving, that he took it with the idea of thanking God for the freedom and safety that God had given to him because Jesus had told him, don't be afraid. Maybe it was a vow that Paul had taken because he didn't feel this fear any longer that had risen up in his heart, and now he takes a vow to God and this vow has ended, and now he cuts his hair to symbolize its termination. All through the Bible, we see where people have taken vows to God David vowed to God and said, I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of his people. The preacher in Ecclesiastes had warned, when thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. You know, I think vows are good things, but they're serious, and they ought to be taken seriously. And when you vow by the side of that loved one, when you vow when you're in distress, don't vow foolishly, as did Jephthah. But if you vow, then pay that vow. And if years ago you vowed a vow that if, and that did come to pass, God really granted it, and you say, well, I was just distraught and upset, I'm sure God doesn't hold me to that. I'm not too sure of that. I'm not too sure of that. Paul had an integrity and a consistency about himself, about his lifestyle. He had time. He had time in control, and he had himself in control of his own life. And he vowed a vow. He paid the vow. He terminated the vow. He had a strong character in his relationship to God. And by that I simply mean Paul took life seriously, took his vows seriously. This next statement is rather foolish, but I don't know how else to say it. I think we've learned this, and that Paul was committed to preaching. Verses 19 and 20 tell us, and he came to Ephesus and left them there, that is Priscilla and Aquila, but he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. You remember Paul had just said, lo, I turn to the Gentiles. Well, he'd meant, of course, in the city of Corinth, but Paul now is going back into the synagogues. He's going back to reason with the Jews. He still even keeps their feast. The Bible says in verse 21 that he wants to keep the feast in Jerusalem. All of this is a part of a man's desire to preach. And he preached to the ones at Ephesus, and he said, I'll come and I will return unto you again. And then I think here's another statement that gives us something of Paul's lifestyle and of his character, because he said, if God will. If God will. I think James gives us an indication of how much what we do depends upon God's will when he said in James 4:15, for that ye ought to say, if the Lord will. Now, we usually stop there and say we will do this or that, but you know, James had something between doing this or that. And you know what it was? If the Lord will, we shall live. If the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. Paul was so conscious of how his physical life was tied to the will of God. It was Paul who quoted the poets and said, in God we live and move and have our very being. We live because God wills. And I'm sure Paul, with all his myriad experiences, was conscious of the fact that had not God been involved, he would not have lived nor accomplished what he lived and accomplished. What's true of Paul is true of you and true of me. Through our strength, through our stick-to-itiveness, through our commitment, through the will of the flesh, we would not be able to accomplish the will of the flesh were it not that God willed us to live and gave us life. And then a part of Paul's lifestyle and manner of life was that he had a great love and concern for churches. He went to Jerusalem. He went to this group at Caesarea. And the Bible tells us that he saluted the church that was there. We get the idea that Paul came to this church and walked by and gave it a good snappy salute. You know, it really means to draw to oneself. To draw to oneself. Paul literally embraced the church. He went to Antioch, a church of greatness, the church that had sent him forth by the will and power of the Spirit of God. And the Bible tells us that he landed in Caesarea and had gone up and saluted the church. He went down to Antioch. And there he had, and after he'd spent some time there, he departed and went all over the country. Now there's another characteristic of Paul. There's something else about him. You know, these churches were all, they were different. Well, you know, when you read Galatia, it was different. Corinth was different. Rome was different. Thessalonica was different. Ephesus was different. And you know, Paul left Priscilla and Aquila at Ephesus. And evidently, they were men. They were a man and a woman, a man and his wife, who understood many of the great truths of God's Word, and Paul had taught them more and they'd learned more. And on that basis of Aquila and Priscilla, Paul was able to write the Ephesian letter, which reaches perhaps the height in what we would call doctrinal truth. But Paul went all over the country. Now, some people might be, you know, that might be an area of criticism. But to Paul, it was a part of his life to love and care for the churches. And he did. In fact, he described his physical sufferings by enumerating the beatings and the stonings and all of these things, and finally concluded how much he suffered by saying, and the care of the churches that fall upon me daily or constantly. Paul cared about the churches. And the Bible tells us that he went about it in order, which has in it the idea of definite schedule, systematically, successively. I guess Paul said, now I want to keep up with all these churches. I want to make sure that I visit all of them and I do everything that I ought to do. There was a systematic thinking about Paul. And he did this in order to strengthen the churches. They had already been evangelized in the sense of being brought together. Now they needed to be taught. And the teaching was designed to set fast upon, to fix firmly upon, to be established. One translator has written, making the disciples strong in the faith. All of us have a manner of life. Well, someday I'm going to establish my lifestyle. That was probably done many, many years ago. But as Christian people, we have a manner of life, a way we live, a way of doing things, things that are important to us, things that we have in our heart and have on our mind. And people know us by the way we live. Our words are believable. when we say, I will do this, or I won't do that, or I have done this, or I haven't done that, our words are believable, but our manner of life is undeniable. What we say is important. What we say is oftentimes true and cannot be set aside. But what we are, what we do, the way we live is an undeniable evidence. And that's what the scriptures say. And it says, by a tree's fruit, you know its character. You know, you can look at the bark and you can tell a lot about a tree. Look at the leaves, you can tell a lot about the tree. Look at the root system, you can tell a lot about the tree. Look at the height of it, you can tell a lot about it. Look at the conformation of it, you can tell a lot about it. But I tell you, the best evidence of what it is the fruit that hangs on its branches. Our lifestyle should consist of two parts. I don't know whether they should be equal or not. Probably not. I doubt seriously. I used to think they were two equal parts to our life. I don't believe that anymore. I believe they're disproportionate. And Jesus mentions this in Luke 6:47 through 49 when he mentions hearing and doing. And I suppose a few years ago I would have said that most of our life ought to be spent, that our lives as Christians should be spent this way, half in hearing and half in doing. I don't believe that anymore. When I first started preaching, I would have said that we need to spend our lives about 30 minutes hearing and about, 23 hours and 30 minutes in doing. Now I've changed. But I really think now we ought to hear a long, long time and then do. Listening's important. Listening's important. Hearing's important. That's an important part of our life because that dictates our actions. Jesus said, I will liken him that heareth my sayings and doeth them. I will liken him to a man that built his house on a rock. Hearing and doing, two great aspects of the Christian's life. Manner of life, style, lifestyle, as we say today. Paul had one, developed over a period of time. I hope you have one. I hope it's as consistent and as oriented toward God as was Paul's.